Strike let himself outside and swiftly closed the back door.
"Any news?"
"Yes, looks like you were right." Strike sat down on a wrought iron garden chair and lit up.
"Go on."
"I've just had coffee with my contact. He can't speak freely, given the nature of what we're talking about, but I put your theory to him and he said, 'That sounds very plausible.' Then I said, 'Fellow politician?' And he said that sounded very likely too. And I said I supposed that in that situation, the press would appeal. And he said yes, he thought so too."
Strike exhaled. "I owe you, Ilsa, thanks. The good news is I'll be able to get out of your hair."
"Calm, we don't mind you staying, you know that."
"The cats don't like me. Nick says they can tell you're a gooner. The comedy circuit lost a shining light when your husband decided on medicine. Dinner's on me tonight and I'll clear out afterwards."
Strike then rang Robin. She picked up on the second ring. "Everything okay?"
"I found out why the press aren't all over us. Della's taken out a super injunction. The papers aren't allowed to report that Chisel hired us in case it breaks the blackmail story. Ilsa's just met her High Court contact and he confirmed it."
There was a pause while Robin digested this information. "So Della convinced a judge that Chisel made up the blackmail?"
"Exactly. That he was using us to dig dirt on enemies. I'm not surprised the judge swallowed it. The whole world thinks Della's whiter than white."
"But Izzy knew why I was there," protested Robin. "The family will have confirmed that he was being blackmailed." Strike tapped ash absent-mindedly into Ilsa's pot of rosemary.
"Will they? Or will they want it all hushed up now he's dead?"
He took her silence as reluctant agreement. "The press will appeal the injunction, won't they?"
"They're already trying, according to Wilson. If I were a tabloid editor, I'd be having us watched. So I think we better be careful. I'm going back to the office tonight, but I think you should stay home."
"For how long?" said Robin. He heard the strain in her voice and wondered whether it was entirely due to the stress of the case.
"We'll play it by ear. Robin, they know you were the one inside the Houses of Parliament. You became the story while he was alive, and you're sure as hell a story now they know who you really are, and he's dead."
She said nothing.
"How are you getting on with the accounts?" he asked.
She had insisted on being given this job, little though either of them enjoyed it.
"They'd look a lot healthier if Chisel had paid his bill." "I'll try and tap the family," said Strike, rubbing his eyes. "But it feels tasteless asking for money before the funeral."
"I've been looking through the photos again," said Robin. In daily contact since finding the body, every one of their conversations wound its way back to the pictures of Chisel's corpse and the room in which they had found him.
"Me too. Notice anything new?"
"Yes, two little brass hooks on the wall. I think the sword was usually..."
"Displayed beneath the missing painting."
"Exactly. Do you think it was Chisel's, from the army?"
"Very possibly. Or some ancestors."
"I wonder why it was taken down, and how it got bent."
"You think Chisel grabbed it off the wall to try and defend himself against his murderer?"
"That's the first time," said Robin quietly. "You've said it. Murderer." A wasp swooped low over Strike, but repelled by his cigarette smoke, buzzed away again.
"I was joking."
"Were you?" Strike stretched his legs out in front of him, contemplating his feet. Stuck in the house, which was warm, he had not bothered with shoes and socks. His bare foot, which rarely saw sunlight, was pale and hairy. The prosthetic foot, a single piece of carbon fibre with no individual toes, had a dull gleam in the sunshine.
"There are odd features," said Strike, as he waggled his remaining toes. "But it's been a week and no arrest. The police will have noticed everything we did."
"Hasn't Wardle heard anything? Vanessa's dad's ill. She's on compassionate leave, or I'd have asked her."
"Wardle's deep in anti-terrorist stuff for the Olympics. Considerately spared the time to call my voicemail and piss himself laughing at my client dying on me, though."
"Cormoran, Did you notice the name on those homeopathic pills I trod on?
No, said Strike. This wasn't one of the photographs he had isolated. What was it?
Lachesis. I saw it when I enlarged the picture.
Why is that significant?
When Chisel came into our office and quoted that Latin poem at Amir and said something about a man of your habits, he mentioned Lachesis. He said she was...
one of the fates.
Exactly. The one who knew when everyone's number was up. Strike smoked in silence for a few seconds.
Sounds like a threat.
I know.
You definitely can't remember which poem it was. Author, perhaps.
I've been trying, but no.
Wait, said Robin suddenly.
He gave it a number.
Catullus, said Strike, sitting up straighter on the iron garden chair.
How do you know?
Because Catullus's poems are numbered, not titled. There was an old copy on Chisel's coffee table. Catullus described plenty of interesting habits. Incest, sodomy, child rape. He might have missed out bestiality. There's a famous one about a sparrow, but nobody buggers it.
Funny coincidence, isn't it?
Said Robin, ignoring the witticism. Maybe Chisel was prescribed the pills and that put him in mind of the fate.
Did he seem to you like the kind of man who'd trust homeopathy?
No, admitted Strike. But if you're suggesting the killer dropped a tube of Lachesis as an artistic flourish...
He heard a distant trill of bells. There's someone at the door, said Robin. I'd better...
Check who it is before you answer, said Strike.
He had had a sudden presentiment. Her footsteps were muffled by what he knew was carpet. Oh, God!
Who is it?
Mitch Patterson.
Has he seen you?
No, I'm upstairs.
Then don't answer.
I won't.
Her breathing had become noisy and ragged. You all right?
Fine, she said, her voice constricted.
What's he?
I'm going to go. I'll call you later.
The line went dead.
Strike lowered the mobile. Feeling a sudden heat in the fingers of the hand not holding the phone, he realized his cigarette had burned to the filter. Stubbing it out on the hot paving stone, he flicked it over the wall into the garden of a neighbor whom Nick and Ilsa disliked, and immediately lit another, thinking about Robin. He was concerned about her. It was to be expected, of course, that she was experiencing anxiety and stress after finding a body and being interviewed by the security services, but he had noticed lapses in concentration over the phone where she asked him the same thing two or three times. There was also what he considered her unhealthy eagerness to get back to the office or out on the street. Convinced that she ought to be taking some time out, Strike hadn't told Robin about a line of investigation he was currently pursuing because he was sure she would insist on being allowed to help. The fact was that for Strike, the Chisel case had begun not with a dead man's story of blackmail, but with Billy Knight's tale of a strangled child wrapped in a pink blanket in the ground. Ever since Billy's last plea for help, Strike had been phoning the telephone number from which it had been made. Finally, on the previous morning, he had got an answer from a curious passerby who had confirmed the box's position on the edge of Trafalgar Square.
Strike. That bastard soldier with a one leg. Billy's fixated on him, thinks he's going to rescue him.
Surely there was a chance, however tiny, that Billy might gravitate back to the place where he had last sought help. Strike had spent a few hours wandering Trafalgar Square on the previous afternoon, knowing how remote was the possibility that Billy would show up, yet feeling compelled to do something, however pointless. Strike's other decision, which was even harder to justify, because it cost money the agency could currently ill afford, was to keep Barclay embedded with Jimmy and Flick.
"It's your money," the Glaswegian said, when the detective gave him his instructions. "But what am I looking for?" "Billy," said Strike. "And in the absence of Billy, anything strange."
Of course, the next lot of accounts would show Robin exactly what Barclay was up to. Strike had a sudden feeling that he was being watched. Ozzy, the bolder of Nick and Ilsa's kittens, was sitting at the kitchen window, beside the kitchen taps, staring through the window with eyes of pale jade. His gaze felt judgmental. Chapter 37. I shall never conquer this completely. There will always be a doubt confronting me. A question. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Wary of breaching the conditions of the super-injunction, photographers stayed away from Chisel's funeral in Woolston. News organizations restricted themselves to brief factual announcements that the service had taken place. Strike, who had considered sending flowers, had decided against it on the basis that the gesture might be taken as a tasteless reminder that his bill remained unpaid. Meanwhile, the inquest into Chisel's death was opened and adjourned, pending further investigations. And then, quite suddenly, nobody was very interested in Jasper Chisel. It was as though the corpse that had been borne aloft for a week upon a swell of newsprint, gossip and rumour, now sank beneath stories of sportsmen and women, of Olympic preparations and predictions, the country in the grip of an almost universal preoccupation, for whether they approved or disapproved of the event, it was impossible to ignore or avoid. Robin was still phoning Strike daily, pressuring him to let her come back to work, but Strike continued to refuse. Not only had Mitch Patterson twice more appeared in her street, but an unfamiliar young busker had spent the whole week playing on the pavement opposite Strike's office, missing chord changes every time he saw the detective, and regularly breaking off halfway through songs to answer his mobile. The press, it seemed, had not forgotten that the Olympics would eventually end, and that there was still a juicy story to be run on the reason Jasper Chisel had hired private detectives. None of Strike's police contacts knew anything about the progress of their colleagues' investigation into the case. Usually able to fall asleep under even the most unpropitious conditions, Strike found himself unusually restful and wakeful by night, listening to the increased noise from the London now heaving with Olympics visitors. The last time he had endured such a long stretch of sleeplessness had been his first week of unconsciousness after his leg had been borne off by the IED in Afghanistan. Then he had been kept awake by a tormenting itch impossible to scratch, because he felt it on his missing foot. Strike hadn't seen Lorelei since the night of the Paralympic reception. After leaving Charlotte in the street, he had set off for Trafalgar Square to try and locate Billy, with the result that he had been even later to dinner with Lorelei than he had expected. Tired, sore, frustrated at his failure to find Billy, and jarred by the unexpected meeting with his ex, he had arrived at the Curry House in the expectation, and perhaps the hope, that Lorelei would have already left. However, she had not only been waiting patiently at the table, she had immediately wrong-footed him with what he mentally characterized as a strategic retreat. Far from forcing a discussion about the future of their relationship, she had apologized for what she claimed to have been a foolish and precipitate declaration of love in bed, which she knew had embarrassed him, and which she sincerely regretted. Strike, who had drunk most of a pint on sitting down, bolstering himself, as he had imagined, for the unpleasant task of explaining that he did not want their relationship to become either more serious or permanent, was stymied. Her claim that she had said, "I love you," as a kind of cri de joie, rendered his prepared speech useless, and given that she had looked very lovely in the lamp-lit restaurant, it had been easier and pleasanter to accept her explanation at face value, rather than force a rupture that, clearly, neither of them wanted. They had texted and spoken a few times during the subsequent week apart, though nowhere near as often as he had talked to Robin. Lorelei had been perfectly understanding about his need to keep a low profile for a while, once he explained that his late client had been the government minister who had suffocated in a plastic bag. Lorelei had even been unfazed when he refused her invitation to watch the opening ceremony of the Olympics with her, because he'd already agreed to spend the evening at Lucy and Greg's. Strike's sister was, as yet, unwilling to let Jack out of her sight, and had therefore declined Strike's offer to take him to the Imperial War Museum over the weekend, offering dinner instead. When he explained to Lorelei how matters stood, Strike could tell that she was hoping that he would ask her to come with him to meet some of his family for the first time. He said, truthfully, that his motive for going alone was to spend time with the nephew whom he felt he had neglected, and Lorelei accepted this explanation good-naturedly, merely asking whether he was free the following night. As the taxi bore him from Bromley South Station towards Lucy and Greg's, Strike found himself mulling the situation with Lorelei, because Lucy usually demanded a bulletin on his love life. This was one of the reasons he avoided these kinds of get-togethers. It troubled Lucy that her brother was still, at the age of nearly 38, unmarried. She had gone so far on one embarrassing occasion as to invite to dinner a woman whom she imagined he might fancy, which had taught him only that his sister grossly misjudged his taste and needs. As the taxi bore him deeper and deeper into middle-class suburbia, Strike found himself face to face with the uncomfortable truth, which was that Lorelei's willingness to accept the casualness of their current arrangement did not stem from a shared sense of disengagement, but from a desperation to keep him on almost any terms. Staring out of the window at the roomy houses with double garages and neat lawns, his thoughts drifted to Robin, who called him daily when her husband was out, and then to Charlotte, holding lightly to his arm as she walked down the Lancaster House staircase in her spike-heeled boots. It had been convenient and pleasurable to have Lorelei in his life these past 10 and a half months, affectionately undemanding, erotically gifted, and pretending not to be in love with him. He could let the relationship continue, tell himself that he was, in that meaningless phrase, seeing how things went, or he could face the fact that he had merely postponed what must be done, and the longer he let things drift, the more mess and pain would result. These reflections were hardly calculated to cheer him up, and as the taxi drew up outside his sister's house, with a magnolia tree in the front garden and the net curtain twitching excitedly, he felt an irrational resentment towards his sister, as though all of it was her fault. Jack opened the front door before Strike could even knock. Given his state the last time Strike had seen him, Jack looked remarkably well, and the detective was torn between pleasure at his recovery and annoyance that he hadn't been allowed to take his nephew out, rather than making the long and inconvenient journey to Bromley. However, Jack's delight in Strike's arrival, his eager questions about everything Strike remembered about their time together in hospital, because he himself had been glamorously unconscious, were touching, as was the fact that Jack insisted upon sitting next to his uncle at dinner and monopolized his attention throughout. It was clear that Jack felt that they had become more closely bonded, for each having passed through the tribulation of emergency surgery. He demanded so many details of Strike's amputation that Greg put down his knife and fork and pushed away his plate with a nauseated expression. Strike had previously formed the impression that Jack, the middle son, was Greg's least favourite. He took a slightly malicious pleasure in satisfying Jack's curiosity, especially as he knew that Greg, who would usually have shut the conversation down, was exercising unusual restraint given Jack's convalescent state. Unconscious of all undercurrents, Lucy beamed throughout, her eyes barely leaving Strike and Jack. She asked Strike nothing about his private life. All she seemed to ask was that he would be kind and patient with her son. Uncle and nephew left the dinner table on excellent terms, Jack choosing a seat next to Strike on the sofa to watch the Olympics opening ceremony and chattering non-stop while they waited for the live broadcast to start, expressing the hope, among other things, that there would be guns, cannons, and soldiers. This innocent remark reminded Strike of Jasper Chisel and his annoyance, reported by Robin, that Britain's military prowess was not to be celebrated on this largest of national stages. This made Strike wonder whether Jimmy Knight was sitting in front of a TV somewhere, readying himself to sneer at what he had castigated as a carnival of capitalism. Greg handed Strike a bottle of Heineken. "Here we go," said Lucy excitedly. The live broadcast began with a countdown. A few seconds in, a numbered balloon failed to burst.
"Let it not be shit," thought Strike,
suddenly forgetting everything else in an upsurge of patriotic paranoia. But the opening ceremony had been so very much the reverse of shit that Strike stayed to watch the whole thing, voluntarily missing his last train, accepting the offer of the sofa bed and breakfasting on Saturday morning with the family.
"Agency doing well, is it?"
Greg asked him over the fry-up Lucy had cooked.
"Not bad," said Strike.
He generally avoided discussing his business with Greg, who seemed to have been wrong-footed by Strike's success. His brother-in-law had always given the impression of being irritated by Strike's distinguished military career. As he fielded Greg's questions about the structure of the business, the rights and responsibilities of his freelance hires, Robin's special status as a salaried partner, and the potential for expansion, Strike detected, not for the first time, Greg's barely disguised hope that there might be something Strike had forgotten or overlooked, too much the soldier to easily navigate the civilian business world. "What's the ultimate aim, though?" he asked, while Jack sat patiently at Strike's side, clearly hoping to talk more about the military. "I suppose you'll be looking to build up the business so that you don't need to be out on the street. Direct them all from the office."
"No," said Strike. "If I'd wanted a desk job, I'd have stayed in the army. The aim is to build up enough reliable employees that we can sustain a steady workload and make some decent money. Short term, I want to build up enough money in the bank to see us through the lean times."
"Seems underambitious," said Greg. "With the free advertising you got after the Ripper case..." "We're not talking about that case now," said Lucy sharply from beside the frying pan. And with a glance at his son, Greg fell silent, permitting Jack to re-enter the conversation with a question about assault courses. Lucy, who had loved every moment of her brother's visit, glowed with pleasure as she hugged him goodbye after breakfast.
"Let me know when I can take Jack out," said Strike, while his nephew beamed up at him.
"I will. And thanks so much, Stick. I'll never forget what you..."
"I didn't do anything," Strike said, thumping her gently on the back. "He did it himself. He's tough, aren't you, Jack? Thanks for a nice evening, Luce."
Strike considered that he had got out just in time. Finishing his cigarette outside the station, with 10 minutes to kill before the next train to central London, he reflected that Greg had reverted over breakfast to that combination of chirpiness and heartiness with which he usually treated his brother-in-law, while Lucy's inquiries after Robin, as he put on his coat, had shown signs of becoming a wide-ranging inquiry into his relationships with women in general. His thoughts had just returned dispiritedly towards Lorelei when his mobile rang.
"Hello?"
"Is this Cormoran?"
said an upper-class female voice he did not immediately recognize.
"Yes. Who's this?"
"Is he Chisel?"
she said, sounding as though she had a head cold.
"Is he?" repeated Strike, surprised. How are you?"
"Oh, bearing up. We, got your invoice."
"Right," said Strike, wondering whether she was about to dispute the total, which was large.
"I'd be very happy to give you payment immediately, if you could... I wonder whether you could possibly come and see me today, if that's convenient. How are you fixed?"
Strike checked his watch. For the first time in weeks he had nothing to do except make his way to Lorelei's later for dinner, and the prospect of collecting a large check was certainly welcome.
"Yeah, that should be fine," he said. "Where are you, Izzy?"
She gave him her address in Chelsea.
"I'll be about an hour."
"Perfect," she said, sounding relieved. "I'll see you then."
Chapter 38 "Oh, this killing doubt," Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. It was almost midday when Strike arrived at Izzy's Muse House in Upper Cheyne Row in Chelsea, a quietly expensive stretch of houses which, unlike those of Ebury Street, were tastefully mismatched. Izzy's was small and painted white, with a carriage lamp beside the front door, and when Strike rang the doorbell, she answered within a few seconds. In her loose black trousers and a black sweater too warm for such a sunny day, Izzy reminded Strike of the first time he had met her father, who had been sporting an overcoat in June. A sapphire cross hung around her neck. Strike thought that she had gone as far into official mourning as modern-day dress and sensibilities would permit.
"Come in, come in,"
she said nervously, not making eye contact, and standing back, waved him into an airy open-plan sitting and kitchen area, with white walls, brightly patterned sofas, and an Art Nouveau fireplace, with sinuous, moulded female figures supporting the mantelpiece. The long rear windows looked out onto a small private courtyard, where expensive wrought iron furniture sat among carefully tended topiary.
"Sit down," said Izzy, waving him towards one of the colourful sofas. "Tea, coffee?"
"Tea would be great, thanks."
Strike sat down and obtrusively extracted a number of uncomfortable beaded cushions from beneath him and took stock of the room. In spite of the cheery modern fabrics, a more traditional English taste predominated. Two hunting prints stood over a table laden with silver-frame photographs, including a large black-and-white study of Izzy's parents on their wedding day. Jasper Chisel, dressed in the uniform of the Queen's Own Hussars, Lady Patricia, toothy and blonde, in a cloud of tulle. Over the mantelpiece hung a large watercolour of three blonde toddlers, which Strike assumed represented Izzy and her two older siblings, Dead Freddy and the unknown Fizzy. Izzy clattered around, dropping teaspoons and opening and closing cupboards without finding what she was looking for. At last, turning down Strike's offer of help, she carried a tray bearing a teapot, bone china mugs and biscuits, the short distance between kitchenette and coffee table, and set it down.
"Did you watch the opening ceremony?"
she asked politely, busy with teapot and strainer.
"I did, yeah," said Strike. "Great, wasn't it?"
"Well, I like the first part," said Izzy, "all the Industrial Revolution bit, but I thought it went, well, a bit PC after that. I'm not sure foreigners will really get why we were talking about the National Health Service. And I must say, I could have done without all the rap music. Help yourself to milk and sugar."
"Thanks."
There was a brief silence, broken only by the tinkling of silver and china. That plush kind of silence, achievable in London only by people with plenty of money. Even in winter, Strike's attic flat was never completely quiet. Music, footsteps and voices filled the Soho Street below, and when pedestrians forsook the area, traffic rumbled through the night, while the slightest breath of wind rattled his insecure windows.
"Oh, your check,"
gasped Izzy, jumping up again to fetch an envelope on the kitchen side.
"Here."
"Thanks very much," said Strike, taking it from her.
Izzy sat down again, took a biscuit, changed her mind about eating it, and put it on her plate instead. Strike sipped tea that he suspected was of the finest quality, but which to him tasted unpleasantly of dried flowers.
Said Izzy at last, "it's quite hard to know where to begin."
She examined her fingers, which were unmanicured.
"I'm scared you'll think I'm bonkers,"
she muttered, glancing up at him through her fair lashes.
"I doubt that," said Strike,
putting down his tea and adopting what he hoped was an encouraging expression.
"Have you heard what they found in Papa's orange juice?"
"No," said Strike.
"Amitriptyline tablets, ground up into powder. I don't know whether you... They're antidepressants. The police say it's quite an efficient, painless suicide method. Sort of belt and braces, the pills and the bag."
She took a sloppy gulp of tea.
"They were quite kind, really, the police. Well, they have training, don't they? They told us if the helium's concentrated enough, one breath and you're asleep.
She pursed her lips together.
The thing is, she said loudly, in a sudden rush of words, I absolutely know that Papa would never have killed himself, because it was something he detested. He always said it was the coward's way out, awful for the family and everybody left behind. And it was strange. There was no packaging for the amitriptyline anywhere in the house. No empty boxes, no blister packs, nothing. Of course, a box would have Kinvara's name on it. Kinvara's the one who's prescribed amitriptyline. She's been taking it for over a year.
Izzy glanced at Strike to see what effect her words had had. When he said nothing, she plunged on.
Papa and Kinvara rowed the night before at the reception, right before I came over to talk to you and Charlie. Papa just told us he'd asked Raff to come over to the Ebury Street house next morning. Kinvara was furious. She asked why, and Papa wouldn't tell her. He just smiled, and that infuriated her.
Why would?
Because she hates all of us, said Izzy, correctly anticipating Strike's question. Her hands were clutched together, the knuckles white. She's always hated anything and anyone that competed with her for Papa's attention or his affection. And she particularly hates Raff, because he looks just like his mother. And Kinvara's always been insecure about Ornella, because she's still very glamorous. But Kinvara doesn't like that Raff's a boy, either. She's always been frightened he'd replace Freddy, and maybe get put back in the will. Kinvara married Papa for his money. She never loved him.
When you say put back...
Papa wrote Raff out of his will when Raff ran... when he did the thing in the car. Kinvara was behind that, of course. She was egging Papa on to have nothing more to do with Raff at all. Anyway, Papa told us at Lancaster House he'd invited Raff around next day, and Kinvara went quiet. And a couple of minutes later, she suddenly announced that she was leaving and walked out. She claims she went back to Ebury Street, wrote Papa a farewell note, but you were there. Maybe you saw it.
Yes, said Strike. I did.
Yes. So she claims she wrote that note, packed her bag, then caught the train back to Woolston. The way the police were questioning us, they seemed to think Kinvara leaving him would have made Papa kill himself. But that's just too ridiculous for words. Their marriage has been in trouble for ages. I think he'd been able to see through her for months and months before then. She's been telling crazy fibs and doing all kinds of melodramatic things to try and keep Papa's interest. I promise you, if Papa had believed she was about to leave him, he'd have been relieved, not suicidal. But of course, he wouldn't have taken that note seriously. He'd have known perfectly well it was more play-acting. Kinvara's got 9 horses and no income. She'll have to be dragged out of Chisel House, just like Tinky the First, my grandpa's 3rd wife, Izzy explained. The Chisel men seem to have a thing for women with big boobs and horses. Flushed beneath her freckles, Izzy drew breath and said, I think Kinvara killed Papa. I can't get it out of my head. Can't focus. Can't think about anything else. She was convinced there was something going on between Papa and Venetia. She was suspicious from the first moment she saw Venetia, and then the sun snooping around convinced her she was right to be worried. And she probably thought Papa reinstating Raff proved that he was getting ready for a new era. And I think she ground up her antidepressants and put them in his orange juice when he wasn't looking. He always had a glass of juice first thing. That was his routine. Then, when he became sleepy and couldn't fight her off, she put the bag over his head, and then, after she'd killed him, she wrote that note to try and make it look as though she was the one who was going to divorce him. And I think she sneaked out of the house after she'd done it, went home to Woolston, and pretended she'd been there when Papa died. Running out of breath, Izzy felt for the cross around her neck and played with it nervously, watching for Strike's reaction, her expression both nervous and defiant. Strike, who had dealt with several military suicides, knew that survivors were nearly always left with a particularly noxious form of grief. A poisoned wound that festered even beyond that of those whose relatives had been dispatched by enemy bullets. He might have his own doubts about the way in which Chisel had met his end, but he was not about to share them with the disorientated, grief-stricken woman beside him. What struck him chiefly about Izzy's diatribe was the hatred she appeared to feel for her stepmother.
It was no trivial charge that she laid against Kinvara, and Strike wondered what it was that convinced Izzy that the rather childish, sulky woman, with whom he had shared 5 minutes in a car, could be capable of planning what amounted to a methodical execution.
"The police," he said at last, "will have looked into Kinvara's movements, Izzy. In a case like this, the spouse is usually the first one to be investigated."
"But they're accepting her story," said Izzy feverishly. "I can tell they are."
"Then it's true," thought Strike. He had too high an opinion of the Met to imagine that they would be slapdash in confirming the movements of the wife, who had had easy access to the murder scene, and who had been prescribed the drugs that had been found in the body.
Who else knew Papa always drank orange juice in the mornings? Who else had access to amitriptyline and the helium?
"Does she admit to buying the helium?" Strike asked.
"No," said Izzy. "But she wouldn't, would she? She just sits there doing her hysterical little girl act." Izzy affected a higher-pitched voice. "I don't know how it got into the house. Why are you all pestering me? Leave me alone. I've been widowed." "I told the police. She attacked Papa with a hammer over a year ago."
Strike froze in the act of raising his unappetizing tea to his lips.
"What?"
"She attacked Papa with a hammer," said Izzy, her pale blue eyes boring into Strike, willing him to understand. "They had a massive row because, well, it doesn't matter why, but they were out in the stables. This was at home, at Chisel House, obviously. And Kinvara grabbed the hammer off the top of a toolbox and smashed Papa over the head with it. She was bloody lucky she didn't kill him then. It left him with olfactory dysfunction. He couldn't smell and taste as well afterwards, and he got cross at the smallest things, but he insisted on hushing it all up. He bundled her off into some residential centre and told everyone she was ill, nervous exhaustion. But the stable girl witnessed the whole thing and told us what had really happened. She had to call the local GP because Papa was bleeding so badly. It would have been all over the papers if Papa hadn't got Kinvara admitted to a psychiatric ward and warned the papers off." Izzy picked up her tea, but her hand was now shaking so badly that she was forced to put it back down again. "She isn't what men think she is," said Izzy vehemently. "They all buy the little girl nonsense, even Raff. She did lose a baby, Izzy. But if he heard a quarter of what Kinvara says about him behind his back, he'd soon change his tune." "And what about the open front door?" Izzy said, jumping subject. "You know about all that. It's how you and Venetia got in, isn't it? That door's never closed properly unless you slam it. Papa knew that. He'd have made sure he closed it properly if he'd been in the house alone, wouldn't he? But if Kinvara was sneaking out early in the morning without wanting to be heard, she'd have had to pull it to and leave it, wouldn't she? She isn't very bright, you know. She'd have tidied away all the amitriptyline packaging, thinking it would incriminate her if she left it. I know the police think the absence of packaging is odd, but I can tell they're all leaning towards suicide, and that's why I wanted to speak to you, Cormoran." Izzy finished, edging a little forward in her armchair. "I want to hire you. I want you to investigate Papa's death."
Strike had known the request was coming almost from the moment the tea had arrived. The prospect of being paid to investigate what was, in any case, preoccupying Strike to the point of obsession was naturally inviting. However, clients who sought nothing but confirmation of their own theories were always troublesome. He could not accept the case on Izzy's terms, but compassion for her grief led him to seek a gentler mode of refusal.
"The police won't want me under their feet, Izzy."
"They don't have to know it's Papa's death you're investigating," said Izzy eagerly. "We could pretend we want you to investigate all those stupid trespasses into the garden that Kinvara claims have been going on. It would serve her bloody well right if we took her seriously now."
"Do the rest of the family know you're meeting me?"
"Oh, yes," said Izzy eagerly. "Fizzy's all for it."
"Is she? Does she suspect Kinvara too?"
"Well, no," said Izzy, sounding faintly frustrated. "But she agrees 100% that Papa couldn't have killed himself."
"Who does she think did it, if not Kinvara?"
"Well,"
said Izzy, who seemed uneasy at this line of questioning,
"actually, Fizz,
has got this crazy idea that Jimmy Knight was involved somehow. But obviously that's ridiculous. Jimmy was in custody when Papa died, wasn't he? You and I saw him being led away by the police the evening before. But Fizz doesn't want to hear that. She's fixated on Jimmy. I've said to her, how did Jimmy Knight know where the amitriptyline and the helium were? But she won't listen. She keeps going on about how Knight was after revenge.
Revenge for what?
What? Said Izzy restlessly, though Strike knew she had heard him. Oh, that doesn't matter now. That's all over.
Snatching up the teapot, Izzy marched away into the kitchen area, where she added more hot water from the kettle.
Fizz is irrational about Jimmy, she said,
returning with her teapot refilled and setting it down with a bang on the table.
She's never been able to stand him since we were teenagers.
She poured herself a second cup of tea, her colour heightened. When Strike said nothing, she repeated nervously,
The blackmail business can't have anything to do with Papa dying. That's all over.
You didn't tell the police about it, did you? Asked Strike quietly.
There was a pause. Izzy turned steadily pinker. She sipped her tea, then said,
No.
Then she said in a rush,
I'm sorry. I can imagine how you and Venetia feel about that, but we're more concerned about Papa's legacy now. We can't face it all getting into the press, Cormoran. The only way the blackmail can have any bearing on his death is if it drove him to suicide, and I just don't believe he'd have killed himself over that or anything else.
Della must have found it easy to get a super injunction, said Strike, if Chisel's own family were backing her up, saying nobody was blackmailing him.
We care more about how Papa's remembered. The blackmail, that's all over and done with.
But Fizzy still thinks Jimmy might have had something to do with your father's death.
That's not... That would be a separate matter from what he was blackmailing about, said Izzy incoherently. Jimmy had a grudge. It's hard to explain. Fizz is just silly about Jimmy.
How does the rest of the family feel about bringing me in again?
Well, Raff isn't awfully keen, but that's nothing to do with him. I'd be paying you.
Why isn't he keen?
Because, said Izzy. Well, because the police questioned Raff more than any of the rest of us. Because, look... Raff doesn't matter, she repeated. I'll be the client. I'm the one who wants you. Just break Kinvara's alibis. I know you can do it.
I'm afraid, said Strike, I can't take the job on those terms, Izzy.
Why not?
The client doesn't get to tell me what I can and can't investigate. Unless you want the whole truth, I'm not your man.
You are. I know you're the best. That's why Papa hired you, and that's why I want you.
Then you'll need to answer questions when I ask them, instead of telling me what does and doesn't matter.
She glared at him over the rim of her teacup, then, to his surprise, gave a brittle laugh.
I don't know why I'm surprised. I knew you were like this. Remember when you argued with Jamie Morm in Nam Long Le Shaker? Oh, you must remember. You wouldn't back down. The whole table was at you at one point. What was the argument about, do you?
The death penalty. Said Strike, caught off guard. Yeah, I remember.
For the space of a blink, he seemed to see not Izzy's clean, bright sitting room, with its relics of a wealthy English past, but the louche, dimly lit interior of a Vietnamese restaurant in Chelsea, where 12 years previously, he and one of Charlotte's friends had got into an argument over dinner. Jamie Morm's face was smoothly porcine in his memory. He had wanted to show up the oik, whom Charlotte had insisted on bringing to dinner instead of Jamie's old friend, Jago Ross.
"And Jamie got really, really angry with you," Izzy said. "He's quite a successful QC now, you know."
"Must have learned to keep his temper in an argument, then," said Strike. And Izzy gave another little giggle. "Izzy," he said, returning to the main issue, "if you mean what you say..."
"I do."
"Then you'll answer my questions," said Strike, drawing a notebook out of his pocket.
Irresolute, she watched him take out a pen.
"I'm discreet," said Strike. "In the past couple of years I've been told the secrets of 100 families and shared not one of them. Nothing irrelevant to your father's death will ever be mentioned again outside my agency. But if you don't trust me..."
"I do,"
said Izzy desperately. and to his slight surprise, she leaned forward and touched him on the knee.
"I do, Cormoran, honestly, but it's hard, talking about Papa."
"I understand that," he said, readying his pen. "So let's start with why the police questioned Raphael so much more than the rest of you." He could tell that she didn't want to answer, but after a moment's hesitation she said,
"Well, I think it was partly because Papa phoned Raph early on the morning he died. It was the last call he made."
"What did he say?"
"Nothing that mattered. It can't have had anything to do with Papa dying. But,"
she rushed on, as though wanting to extinguish any expression her last words might have made,
"I think the main reason Raph isn't keen on me hiring you is that he rather fell for your Venetia while she was in the office, and now, well, obviously, he feels a bit of an idiot that he poured his heart out to her."
"Fell for her, did he?" said Strike.
"Yes. So it's hardly surprising he feels everyone's made a fool of him."
"The fact remains.
I know what you're going to say, but
if you want me to investigate, it'll be me who decides what matters, Izzy, not you. So, I want to know..." He ticked off all the times she had said that information didn't matter on his fingers as he named them. "What your father called Raphael about the morning he died. What your father and Kinvara were rowing about when she hit him round the head with a hammer. And what your father was being blackmailed about." The sapphire cross winked darkly as Izzy's chest rose and fell. When at last she spoke, it was jerkily.
"It's not up to me to tell you about what Papa and Raph said to each other the last time they spoke. That's for Raph to say."
"Because it's private?"
"Yes," she said, very pink in the face. He wondered whether she was telling the truth.
"You said your father had asked Raphael over to the house in Ebury Street the day he died. Was he rearranging the time? Cancelling?"
"Cancelling? Look, you'll have to ask Raph," she reiterated.
"All right," said Strike, making a note. "What caused your stepmother to hit your father around the head with a hammer?" Izzy's eyes filled with tears. Then, with a sob, she pulled a handkerchief out of her sleeve and pressed it to her face.
"I didn't want to tell you that because I didn't want you to think badly of Papa. Now he's... You see, he did something that..."
Her broad shoulders shook as she emitted unromantic snorts. Strike, who found this frank and noisy anguish more touching than he would have found delicate eye-dabbing, sat in impotent sympathy while she tried to gasp out her apologies.
"Don't be silly," he said gruffly. "Of course you're upset."
But she seemed deeply ashamed of this loss of control, and her hiccuping return to calm was punctuated with further flustered sorries. At last, she wiped her face dry, as roughly as though cleaning a window, said one final,
"I'm so sorry."
She straightened her spine and said, with a forcefulness Strike rather admired, given the circumstances,
"If you take the case, once we've signed on the dotted line, I'll tell you what Papa did that made Kinvara hit him."
"I assume," said Strike, "the same goes for the reason that Wynne and Knight were blackmailing your father."
"Look," she said, tears welling again, "don't you see? It's Papa's memory, his legacy now. I don't want those things to be the thing people remember about him. Please help us, Corm, please. I know it wasn't suicide, I know it wasn't."
He let his silence do the work for him. At last, her expression piteous, she said with a catch in her voice,
"All right. I'll tell you all about the blackmail, but only if Fizz and Torx agree."
"Who's Torx?" inquired Strike.
"Torquil, Fizz's husband. We swore we wouldn't ever tell anyone, but I'll talk to them, and if they agree, I'll tell you everything."
"Doesn't Raphael get consulted?"
"He never knew anything about the blackmail business. He was in jail when Jimmy first came to see Papa, and anyway, he didn't grow up with us, so he couldn't. Raph never knew."
"And what about Kinvara?" asked Strike. Did she know?
Oh, yes, said Izzy, and a look of malice hardened her usually friendly features.
But she definitely won't want us to tell you.
Oh, not to protect Papa, she said, correctly reading Strike's expression. To protect herself. Kinvara benefited, you see. She didn't mind what Papa was up to, so long as she reaped the rewards.
Chapter 39. Naturally, I talk as little about it as possible. It is better to be silent about such things. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Robin was having a bad Saturday, following an even worse night. She had woken with a yelp at 4 a.m., with the sensation of being still tangled in the nightmare in which she had been carrying a whole bag full of listening devices through darkened streets, knowing that men in masks were following her. The old knife wound on her arm had been gaping open, and it was the trail of her spurting blood that her pursuers were following, and she knew she would never make it to the place where Strike was waiting for the bag of bugs.
What?
Matthew had said groggily, half asleep.
Nothing,
Robin had replied, before lying sleepless until 7, when she felt entitled to get up. A scruffy young blonde man had been lurking in Albury Street for the past 2 days. He barely bothered to conceal the fact that he was keeping their house under observation. Robin had discussed him with Strike, who was sure that he was a journalist rather than a private detective, probably a junior one, dispatched to keep tabs on her because Mitch Patterson's hourly rate had become an unjustifiable expense. She and Matthew had moved to Albury Street to escape the place where the Shacklewell Ripper had lurked. It was supposed to be a place of safety, yet it, too, had become contaminated by contact with unnatural death. Mid-morning, Robin had taken refuge in the bathroom before Matthew could realize she was hyperventilating again. Sitting on the bathroom floor, she had recourse to the technique she had learned in therapy, cognitive restructuring, which sought to identify the automatic thoughts of pursuit, pain and danger that sprang into her mind, given certain triggers.
He's just some idiot who works for the Sun. He wants a story, that's all. You're safe. He can't get at you. You're completely safe.
When Robin emerged from the bathroom and went downstairs, she found her husband slamming kitchen doors and drawers as he threw together a sandwich. He did not offer to make one for her.
What are we supposed to tell Tom and Sarah, with that bastard staring through the windows?
Why would we tell Tom and Sarah anything?
Asked Robin blankly.
We're going to theirs for dinner tonight.
Oh, no,
groaned Robin.
I mean, yes, sorry, I forgot.
Well, what if the bloody journalist follows us?
We ignore him, said Robin.
What else can we do?
She heard her mobile ringing upstairs, and glad of the excuse to get out of Matthew's vicinity, went to answer it.
Aye, said Strike. Good news. Izzy's hired us to look into Chisel's death.
Well, he corrected himself.
What she actually wants is for us to prove Kinvara did it, but I managed to broaden the remit.
That's fantastic,
whispered Robin, carefully closing the bedroom door and sitting down on the bed.
I thought you'd be pleased, said Strike. Now, what we need for starters is a line on the police investigation, especially forensics. I've just tried Wardle, but he's been warned not to talk to us. They seem to have guessed I'd still be sniffing around. Then I tried Anstis, but nothing doing. He's full-time on the Olympics and doesn't know anyone on the case. So I was going to ask, is Vanessa back off compassionate leave?
Yes,
said Robin, suddenly excited. It was the first time she had had the useful contact, rather than Strike.
But even better than Vanessa, she's dating a guy in forensics, Oliver. I've never met him, but...
If Oliver would agree to talk to us, said Strike, that would be fantastic. Tell you what, I'll call Shanker, see whether he'll sell me something we can offer in exchange. Call you back.
He hung up. Though hungry, Robin did not go back downstairs, but stretched out on the smart mahogany bed, which had been a wedding gift from Matthew's father. It was so cumbersome and heavy
that it had taken the full complement of removal men, sweating and swearing under their breath, to haul it up the stairs in pieces and reassemble it in the bedroom. Robin's dressing table, on the other hand, was old and cheap. Light as an orange crate without its drawers in, it had required only one man to pick it up and place it between the bedroom windows. 10 minutes later, her mobile rang again.
That was quick.
Yeah, we're in luck. Shankar's having a rest day. Our interests happen to coincide. There's somebody he wouldn't mind the police picking off. Tell Vanessa we're offering information on Ian Nash.
Ian Nash, repeated Robin, sitting up to grab pen and paper and make a note of the name.
Who exactly?
Gangster. Vanessa will know who he is, said Strike.
How much did it cost? Asked Robin.
The personal bond between Strike and Shankar, profound in its way, never interfered with Shankar's rules of business.
Half the first week's fee, said Strike. But it'll be money well spent if Oliver comes across with the goods. How are you?
What? Said Robin, disconcerted.
I'm fine. Why'd you ask?
Don't suppose it's ever occurred to you that I've got a duty of care as your employer.
We're partners.
You're a salaried partner. You could sue for poor working conditions.
Don't you think, said Robin, examining the forearm where the 8-inch purple scar still stood out, livid against her pale skin, I'd have already done that if I was going to. But if you're offering to sort out the loo on the landing...
I'm just saying, persisted Strike, it'd be natural if you'd had a bit of reaction. Finding a body isn't many people's idea of fun.
I'm absolutely fine, lied Robin. I have to be fine, she thought, after they had bidden each other goodbye. I'm not losing everything, all over again.
Chapter 40. Your starting point is so very widely removed from his, you see. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. At 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning, Robin, who had again slept in the spare room, got up and dressed herself in jeans, T-shirt, sweatshirt and trainers. Her backpack contained a dark wig that she had bought online and which had been delivered the previous morning under the very nose of the skulking journalist. She crept quietly downstairs so as not to wake Matthew, with whom she had not discussed her plan. She knew perfectly well that he would disapprove. There was a precarious peace between them, even though dinner on Saturday night with Tom and Sarah had been an awful affair, in fact, precisely because dinner had been so dreadful. It had started inauspiciously because the journalist had indeed followed them up the street. They had succeeded in shaking him off, largely due to Robin's counter-surveillance training, which had led them to dodge unseen out of a crowded tube compartment just before the doors closed, leaving Matthew aggravated by what he considered undignified, childish tricks. But even Matthew could not lay the blame for the rest of the evening at Robin's door. What had begun as a light-hearted analysis over dinner of their failure to win the charity cricket match had turned suddenly nasty and aggressive. Tom had suddenly lashed out drunkenly at Matthew, telling him he was not half as good as he thought he was, that his arrogance had grated on the rest of the team, that indeed he was not popular in the office, that he put people's backs up, rubbed them the wrong way. Rocked by the sudden attack, Matthew had tried to ask what he had done wrong at work, but Tom, so drunk that Robin thought he must have started on the wine long before their arrival, had taken Matthew's hurt incredulity as provocation.
"Don't play the fucking innocent with me," he had shouted. "I'm not going to stand for it any more. Belittling me and fucking needling me."
"Was I?" Matthew asked Robin, shaken, as they walked back towards the tube in the darkness. "No," said Robin, honestly. "You didn't say anything nasty to him at all." She added tonight only in her head. It was a relief to be taking a hurt and bewildered Matthew home, rather than the man she usually lived with, and her sympathy and support had won her a couple of days' ceasefire at home. Robin was not about to jeopardize their truce by telling Matthew what she was planning this morning,
to throw the still-lurking journalist off her trail. She couldn't afford to be followed to a meeting with a forensic pathologist, especially as Oliver, according to Vanessa, had needed a great deal of persuasion to meet Strike and Robin in the first place.